Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Tuesday, June 19th. Cloudy and mild, 70% chance of rain, more rain that is, a high of 69. And rain moving through the area right now and a lot of rain to our west, so it could be raining for the better part of the morning. Here are the numbers, 62 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. Wind from the northeast at 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for the morning show also comes from UW Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's degree program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers, more at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show discussing a book that some of you may have heard of that has just been revised and re-released called Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy. It is an exploration of how modern economies operate and in some ways that are markedly different from perhaps economies of the past. And the really crucial role that innovation plays in making economies truly healthy. And it is the contention of William Janeway that America has yielded its place in the arena of innovation in a way that he finds quite disconcerting, actually. And he certainly hopes that America will find a way to reassert itself as the innovation leader that it has so often been in the past. William Janeway has been a bold and successful venture capital investor for several decades, built and led the Warburg Pincus technology investment team that have made a very, very big difference in building the entire internet economy. He received his PhD in economics from Cambridge University, and he is a member of the board of the Social Science Research Council of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and of the Fields Institute for Research in the Mathematical Sciences. This book, again, is titled Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, and it is published by Cambridge University Press. William H. Janeway, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, and I'll be a lot more responsive if you will call me Bill.
I'll try to do that. Explain to our listeners what prompted you to want to revise and update your book. What is going on right now in the current scene that prompted you to want to do that?
Sure. First of all, what motivated me was a recognition that the context in which the U.S. had demonstrated extraordinary leadership in developing all of the components of the digital revolution in which I spent my 30-year sabbatical from the university, from academia, deeply engaged in, that the key components of that experience had changed and now changed radically as we looked back on the decade from the global financial crisis and the Great Recession. When I first reflected on my 30 years in the trenches of venture capital, engaged in funding companies that were contributing to building the platform for digital commerce, for social media, I realized that, in fact, I and my colleagues in the venture community and the entrepreneurs we backed were all, in fact, dancing on a platform that had been constructed by the United States government, by the Department of Defense, by DARPA, which had funded the creation of computer science as a discipline and all the computer and semiconductor projects and indeed the software industry as a whole, and of course on to the development of the internet. And that work that we were doing, dancing on that platform, had then been enormously amplified and accelerated in its impact on the economy by the great speculative financial bubble of the late 1990s, the end of the last century. So I formulated a kind of concept that I called the three-player game, a kind of indeterminate set of reciprocal interactions between a mission-driven state, the U.S. government, at the leadership of the free world against the Soviet Union and the Cold War, which provided legitimate basis for funding the kind of far-out research that produced the digital revolution, and financial speculators looking to jump on the next big thing, independent in each case of an immediate quantifiable economic value. And as I reflected last year on how that game had evolved, I realized that, first of all, the U.S. government has basically dropped out of the game. The U.S. government, somewhat going back as far as the Reagan administration, had been rendered, in effect, illegitimate as an economic actor, particularly when you consider the next potential needed revolution, the Green Revolution, the response to climate change. The U.S. has abdicated from participation in that as a nation state. And then second, and this was really the driving factor, I realized that the digital revolution that had been sponsored in all of its critical components by the American state had matured to the stage, accelerated by that bubble, had matured to the state where it was turning on, it was challenging the authority of government at multiple levels, on multiple dimensions, and even, as we saw in 2016, undermining the integrity of the political process on which the authority of government ultimately rests. That was the most strategic driving motivation for going back and, if you like, re-chewing my cabbage in light of the clear discontinuity that had taken place since the processes that I celebrated, that I had begun by celebrating, had occurred.
Mm. You tell us in the book that actually early in our country's history, the role that the federal government played in this so-called three-player game was relatively limited. At what point did that start to change? At what point did the federal government begin to be actually a very significant player and the kind of player that you hope they will become again?
Ironically, the first dramatic change, and we still live with key results of it, came in the first Republican administration under Abraham Lincoln in the context of the Civil War. It was, on the one hand, the massive grant of federal land to subsidize the building of the Transcontinental Railroad and create a continental market for the American economy, but it was also in the incredibly imaginative, creative decision to fund through, again, the disposition, the gift of federal lands to the states to create the land-grant universities, the great state universities. And for 100 years, those universities were public goods. They provided free access for bright, driven, motivated kids to contribute to society broadly, not in any limited sense. But it was a clear decision that there was social, national benefit from federal investments that could, over many generations, not for immediate economic value, not costed out by, you know, green eye shade accountants in terms of the rate of return, that those investments were of strategic importance. Before that, individual states made investments. The Erie Canal that essentially made New York the greatest commercial and financial capital of the world, it was financed by bonds that were guaranteed by the state of New York. It was called DeWitt Clinton's Folly, the governor of the state of New York, and it had, again, a transformational impact that's lasted now for 200 years.
So you are very much concerned by this sort of abdication of the federal government from what had been a potent role that it played in just generally in terms of innovation and also very specifically in terms of our own economy. And, of course, our economy is now very much part of a global economy. How do you see that changing, and what would be the most important ways in which you would want to see that reversed?
Well, for government-state intervention to make a big difference requires more than just the perception that markets aren't doing the job. There's a long academic empirical history that conclusively demonstrates that on their own, competitive for-profit companies will not invest, quote, enough, unquote, in long-term research and development because they cannot, in the nature of things, capture the full returns and because they can't even know what the full returns are going to be. So there's a long-established case for government funding upstream forward research. And that is a case that's been accepted broadly around the world, in Europe and in Asia, at least as much as in the United States. However, the magnitude of funding is not the sort that is going to create the kinds of technological revolutions that were driven by railroads, electrification, the automobile and the highway system, and the internet and computing. Those have taken missions that transcend economic calculus, national development, national security. I like to say that when you hear political leaders use the language of war, as when Richard Nixon declared war on cancer way back in 1972, they're saying that this cause, this mission, is so important that we're going to suspend cost-benefit analysis. We're going to do what it takes to be effective, not efficient. And in fact, efficiency, a narrow focus on the efficient allocation of resources to realize the richest returns in the shortest term possible, that's the enemy of the kinds of innovations that have changed the world since the 18th century. So what we're presented with today is a curious set and a distressing set of paradoxes. On the one hand, as I say, the government, the federal U.S. government, has been rendered too weak and feeble and illegitimate and compromised to respond to the consequences of the digital revolution that it fostered. The globalization, the financialization, the power of automation, the radical disruption of the labor market and the lives of the people in the labor market. That's on the one hand. On the second hand, we have looming in front of us a cause and a mission at least as pressing as that of the Cold War. It is captured by that phrase that's been banned from Washington, at least from the executive branch, climate change. That response to climate change offers the same potential for legitimizing the broad, deep commitment to fundamental research, to technological development, and to the deployment of the new technologies to generate the green, low-carbon economy that the world desperately needs. And the follow-on to that is that while we have abdicated from that challenge, the rest of the world has not. And most importantly, most significantly, and unquestionably, the leader in committing resources to it is China.
So you see us falling behind China in a very big way.
I see us certainly exposed, and exposed along exactly the lines that one might expect to falling behind and becoming, going from being the leader to a follower. It's not guaranteed. It's not given. This takes decades. It took decades for the U.S. to establish the leadership position as the successor to the United Kingdom, to Great Britain, as the leader of the innovation economy. It took, arguably, you could say, from the late 90s, last years of the 19th century until the clear establishment of U.S. leadership with World War II. And it will not, it is not the case that China is not without its contradictions and challenges, which its leadership from time to time clearly acknowledges. So, but it is clear today that they are investing on a scale both in the fundamental research and in the acceptance of the need to shift the center of gravity of their economy in a time scale that is measured in a few decades and is not simply ignored as a threat. And of course, the irony here is that investing in transforming the infrastructure of the economy towards a low carbon generation and consumption would generate so many jobs, would create so many new industries, and would offer the private sector a range of major new opportunities for profit. And we're simply not paying any attention to that. We are at some of the state levels, certainly in California, and to an extent in New York and some of the other states. But this is the scale of the task, just as the scale of the task of building the foundations of the digital economy are far beyond the scope and capacity of any individual state.
Right. I want to make sure before we run out of time that I give you a chance to share with our listeners some of the intriguing things you have to say about bubbles, bubbles that we are talking about within the context of how economies function and how sometimes bubbles develop that then burst and that lead to downturns. You actually have a chapter in your book which is called The Necessity of Bubbles, and you explain how in fact this is a pretty much essential component to a healthy and vibrant innovative economy. Explain to our listeners your understanding of how these bubbles work, why they are necessary, and how we need to understand them more comprehensively.
So that chapter on the necessity of bubbles is preceded by a chapter called The Banality of Bubbles. That is, bubbles are banal. Bubbles are boringly common in the history of capitalism. Wherever there are markets and assets, you will find momentum investing, herding behavior by investors, fear of missing out, and the generation of a bubble. Most of the bubbles we can observe in history have focused on assets that generate no long-term productive contribution to raising living standards. Bubbles, the span, the spectrum of assets that have been subject to financial bubbles range from tulip bulbs to real estate, residential and commercial, to bonds of new countries, to bitcoins indeed, but occasionally, financial speculators have fastened on one of those new technologies that, when deployed at scale, create the basis for a new economy. The railroads in the United Kingdom in the 1830s and 40s, in the United States in the 1850s and after the Civil War, they were financed by massive waves of speculation. Electrification in the U.S., the Roaring Twenties, the greatest economic contribution of the Roaring Twenties was the extraordinary increase in electric generating power and in the regional electricity grids that delivered the power of electricity to the factory door and to the household door. transform the world. Similarly, the bubble that I and many of your listeners lived through and in some cases prospered from, in some cases were frustrated by, the bubble of the great internet dot-com bubble at the end of the 20th century, not only financed the laying down of fiber optic cables all over the world, but also funded the exploration of what to do with this new stuff. Without that bubble, Amazon would never have had access to the $2.5 billion that it took to go from an idea, from a concept, to a profitable, cash-generating, self-sustaining business. So, and that is why the bubbles proved to be necessary. They solve what economists call a coordination failure in time. Why would I put up the first dollar unless I know, I am confident, that there'll be enough money coming in behind me to make my first dollar valuable? That's the venture capitalist question. The bubble solves that problem, answers that question, and that's why we see them not only wastefully throwing away money on objects of speculation that will never make an economic contribution, but occasionally proving to be necessary in creating a succession of new economies that have developed over the last 200 years.
Well, that and much more is explored in your fascinating book called Doing Capitalism in the Innovation Economy, Reconfiguring the Three-Player Game Between Markets, Speculators, and the State. This is the second edition of the book published by Cambridge University Press, the author William H. Janeway. I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you about your important book. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
And the time is 8:32. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have pouring rain here at our WGTD studios, and we will update you on today's wet weather forecast at the top of the hour. Here's part two of today's program. I always enjoy the opportunity to come to understand the meaning of words more thoroughly and more completely. And that is one of the pleasures in reading a new book called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World, a book which helps us understand in much more comprehensive fashion what is meant by terms like imagination, creativity, innovation. Those are terms which many of us, most of us probably, use pretty much interchangeably. But they each play a really important role, a crucial role, in successful entrepreneurship in this modern world in which we all live and try to function and succeed. And the author of this book, Insight Out, is Dr. Tina Selig. She earned a PhD in neuroscience from Stanford University Medical School and is now professor of the practice in the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford School of Engineering, and also executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. So for many years now, she has been working with young people to help them understand and then harness their own creative ideas and entrepreneurial ventures. She is responsible for a previous bestseller called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and another book called Ingenious, A Crash Course on Creativity. And this newest book is published by HarperCollins. Again, it is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. And Professor Tina Selig, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Wow, that was such a fabulous introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. And this is a great book. I have really enjoyed exploring it on a couple of different levels. I wonder if we could start with the rather personal note on which the book begins, with the story you relate of coming across a letter which you yourself had, in effect, written to yourself 30 years earlier.
Yeah, it was quite an amazing story. I mean, really, somebody couldn't have made this up. I wrote this book called What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and soon after it came out, I got an email from an old friend I hadn't seen since I was a teenager. And he said, gosh, you know, is this the same Tina Seelig? We went to camp together when we were kids. And so I thought, wow, of course. And I knew that he had sent me a bunch of letters in those days when we actually wrote letters, you know, on paper. So I went through a big box of letters my parents had sent to me when they moved, and I found the letters he wrote. But more interesting, I stumbled upon one letter I had written to myself on the eve of my 20th birthday. Now, you realize I'd written this book, What I Wish I Knew When I Was 20, and all of a sudden this letter from 30 years earlier on the eve of my 20th birthday pops into my hand. And the letter basically said, I'm completely lost. I don't know what I'm doing. I have such huge dreams for myself. I have no idea how to get from where I am now to where I want to be. And I could feel that every day now teaching at Stanford, the same thing in my students. The idea that they have such incredible aspirations, and I felt like it was my responsibility to think about how do you actually get your ideas out of your head and into the world? How do you go through that process? And even after years teaching this topic, I realized that there were a lot of miscommunications and wanted to put a stake in the ground that was going to help other people make their dreams come true and sort of live the lives that they dream to live.
I really appreciated something that you said about the way in which at least much of formal education tends to fail its students. And I'm applauding that as someone who happens to teach at a college as my full-time job. So I'm in the trenches with you, but I see this happen, and I've certainly been guilty of it myself. You say at one point, unfortunately, most formal education deals with memorization as opposed to innovation. It focuses on learning about heroes as opposed to teaching students to be heroic. And it presents problems with one right answer as opposed to real-life challenges with an endless number of viable solutions. Here's my favorite line. People should emerge from school with agency, feeling empowered to address the opportunities and challenges that await them. I guess what you're saying is you came to realize in a clearer way your responsibility as a college professor to offer that up to your students.
Exactly. Well, you know, we live in a very different world than our education was designed for, right? It was designed before there was books and the internet, and, you know, people had to get up and lecture to transmit information. But information is a commodity now. We can all find out this information. And the world is changing so fast. It really is our responsibility to teach people, A, how to learn, and how to tap into their passions. So that they can solve the problems that they really want to solve. The world is filled with lots of challenges, and we really need to prepare people to address them, you know, whether they're the individual challenges in their own life to the challenges that, you know, face the planet.
Hmm. Before we start talking about your book a little more specifically, I wonder if you could say a word about this thing called the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. I suspect that the whole reason for its existence folds nicely into what we are going to be talking about today.
Great. Yeah. So I'm fortunate enough to be the executive director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. This is a program I helped build over the last 16 years. And essentially, our philosophy is this. We're in the School of Engineering at Stanford. And the philosophy is that it's no longer good enough for students to come out of school with a purely technical training. They need to understand the entrepreneurial world in which they're going to be working, whether they're individual contributors, running a team, leading an organization, or even starting a company. They need to know how to put together effective teams. They need to know how to lead. They need to know how to negotiate. They need to know how to be creative problem solvers. In fact, to be honest, we say that teaching entrepreneurship is a Trojan horse for teaching very, very important life skills. These skills are important no matter what you do, and you can be entrepreneurial in everything you do.
I guess that's a really great place for us to start, because actually I think that is really crucial to us even being able to take in a lot of the ideas that you share here, because I think the idea of being an entrepreneur or entrepreneurship or entrepreneurial skills, that's a term that we tend to think of fairly restrictively. And I, for one, have never used that term in describing anything that I do in my very busy, complex life.
And in fact, in the way that you're using this term, it's a term we should not be scared of, and we should readily apply to ourselves, even if we've never done that before. Explain how we can open up this our sense of what it means to be entrepreneurial and why we should do that.
Oh, thank you so much for asking that. If you came to our offices at Stanford, painted on the wall in very big letters, it says, entrepreneurs do much more than imaginable with much less than seems possible. And that is the core of what it means to be entrepreneurial. It means seizing opportunities, leveraging resources, making things happen. I am sure you do that every single day in your life. And if you understand that you're an entrepreneur, it gives you that mindset that really you are a problem solver. It's interesting. We had a brand new dean, and she's fabulous, who just started in the School of Engineering, and she's a physicist. Quite talented, and at first she came in and was sort of allergic to the term entrepreneurship. I mean, she was very, very actively saying, I don't like this word. And she went and talked with every single faculty member in the School of Engineering at Stanford. That's hundreds of people. And she, at the end, said, I've changed my mind. I understand now that entrepreneurship is about problem solving, and that that's what we do here, and that is core to the philosophy and the approach that we have here. And so it's something that is super important for everyone to embrace, from young kids to anyone, you know, of any age, that they too can address the challenges around them and come up with really, really creative solutions.
I appreciate how you take this apart in the first chapter of the book, saying that there are three elements to the entrepreneurial mind, that you need to see the world as opportunity-rich. You need to have a specific set of tools for solving problems, and each of those was addressed in earlier books. And this book really points to that third element, which is crucial to successful entrepreneurship, moving from inspiration to implementation.
Yeah, so I didn't realize until I got to the end that this book was the third part of the trilogy. Now, the book's going to certainly be read in any order. They're not designed to be read 1, 2, 3. But what I wish I knew when I was 20 is really about having an entrepreneurial mindset, about seeing the world as opportunity-rich. Ingenious is really, you get to walk right into my classroom, and it's all about the tools I teach about creativity and innovation. That book's called Ingenious. And this book really weaves them both together and shows the relationship between your attitudes and your actions. And essentially, I walk people through this invention cycle, going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship, showing the attitudes and actions that have to happen along the way to really bring your ideas to life.
As you are introducing us to this concept, one of the things you do is help us understand the background behind the phrase thinking outside the box, which a lot of us use rather carelessly. And it's so interesting to know exactly the origins of this phrase. Share that with our listeners.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I personally am not a fan of that phrase. And in fact, most of the people I know who teach creativity aren't either. Because it's used as a catch-all. It's used as a cliche. You know, if I ask people, hey, what does creativity mean to you? They go, well, thinking outside the box. I said, well, what does that mean? And it turns out that term comes from the old puzzle that you might be familiar with, where you have nine dots, you know, rows of three dots, and your goal is to create, to connect all the dots using lines, four or fewer lines, without taking the pen off the paper. And the only way to actually do that is to draw beyond the frame, the invisible frame of that box, to allow the lines to connect. And that's where the term thinking outside the box comes from. Now, most people don't know that, and so when they even say it, they don't even know what that means. So I really challenge people to think much more systematically about what it means to be creative and what tools you actually need to make that happen.
Right after you explain the origins of the phrase, you use another phrase which I find really intriguing. And it's really the point of your whole book, but I sort of love the way these words kind of frame this in a way that is kind of maybe surprising to us. You're saying, in reality, creativity requires a complex set of skills, attitudes, and actions. I mean, much more important than thinking outside the box would suggest. Intimately related to imagination, innovation, and entrepreneurship. Here's the part I love. To harness our creativity, we need a robust robust set of definitions for all parts of the creative and entrepreneurial process.
Right.
But I think that's so intriguing. I think most of us, when we think about creativity, think of it as something that, by its very nature, needs to be unleashed and not harnessed or limited in any way. And, of course, in a sense, that kind of creativity is so aimless that it ends up maybe accomplishing nothing or very little. And this notion of harnessing creativity for a productive end, that's really valuable, and probably especially valuable for people that we immediately and most obviously think of as being creative.
But think about it. We harness our physical abilities when we become an athlete, or our artistic abilities when we become, you know, a painter, or our musical abilities. You know, we have all of these innate abilities, and yet if they're not used and harnessed, we don't have a coach, we don't have someone who's going to help us really use our muscles the right way and to look at things in a very thoughtful way as an artist, we end up being very sloppy. And the same thing is true with creativity. With a framework, with a set of tools, you can really focus your abilities and make yourself stronger. I mean, just as if I exercise, I make my muscles stronger. If I use my creativity in a very thoughtful way, I get stronger at that as well.
Absolutely. And towards that end, this book then really helps us sort of understand this whole process.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Right. So you craft something which you call at one point a scaffolding of skills, which is important here. And it helps us distinguish between terms which you yourself say you've often used indiscriminately, as though they're pretty much the same thing. And the longer you have explored this, the more you realize that these terms are each distinct from the other. The terms are imagination leads to creativity, creativity to innovation, innovation to entrepreneurship. But we need to make sure we're really clear about imagination, creativity, innovation, and how they are each their own unique step in this process.
Yeah, this is really important. And you bring up the fact that I do admit that for years I used the words interchangeably. You know, people conflate the words imagination and creativity. You know, they use them interchangeably, or creativity and innovation. But I realized that's a huge missed opportunity. So the framework that I create is very simple, and I wanted it to be simple so that it's easy to remember and then easy to harness. So the idea is that imagination is envisioning things that don't yet exist. Pretty simple, right? It's something we do all the time. Okay? Creativity is applying our imagination to address a challenge. But we might be coming up with a solution that's been invented before. That's fine. It's new to me. It might not be new to the world. Innovation, though, is applying that creativity to come up with really unique solutions, things that are unique to the world. And entrepreneurship is applying your innovation to bring the invention of whatever sort to the rest of the world. Now, at each step along the way, there's a set of actions and attitudes that are required to get you to the next step. I liken this to the process of learning to talk, right? We start out with sounds we make. We apply those sounds to make words, apply those words to make sentences, and those sentences to make stories. And that same sort of hierarchy applies when going from imagination to creativity to innovation to entrepreneurship.
Hmm. I think as I glanced at your book the first time, the part that was maybe the most surprising to me was trying to take apart something like imagination. Because I think most of us, when we think about imagination and being imaginative, we think of that as something that, you know, maybe we have it or we don't. I mean, an entirely innate ability that some people have in great quantities and others seem to scarcely have any imagination at all. But generally speaking, I think most of us think of it as something that either you have it or you don't, like you're a blonde or you're a brunette. And of course,
I guess you can change that too.
Absolutely. Yeah, no kidding. But you really help us understand that imagination is a tool that can be fostered and nurtured just like anything else.
You bet. In fact, there are some interesting surprises in this. When I started digging into it, I realized, you know, most people think about that their imagination is something that you just sit around with your eyes closed under a tree and you're imaginative. Well, that's one way to do it. But really, most great ideas come from starting with a set of data. The more experiences you have in the world, the more you have to work with. because your imagination is essentially connecting, combining things that already are in your mind. This is why people who live in very enriched environments can have much more rich imagination than those who grew up in a very limited environment. And so the more engaged you are in the world and the more really active engagement, paying attention, listening better, watching better, you know, feeling things more deeply, the more you have to work with and the more you can envision what might be different. In fact, it's critically important to realize that our passions, our ideas about what could be, are designed after we're engaged. Before it's your passion, it's probably something you know nothing about. And this is really important because you can do anything from waiting tables to taking a trip around the world, and those experiences are going to really light up opportunities.
Hmm. So one of the steps you lay out is the importance of moving from engaging in the world with the world in a fashion that fosters our own curiosity to this idea of then envisioning. And this is probably an important step that a lot of us don't fully appreciate.
Yes. As I just mentioned, right, you engage first and then you envision what might be different. You know, your passions and the things that you care about follow that engagement. I tell a number of stories in the book of people who are going about their lives in a very expected way, and then something happens to them that triggers their motivation to do something differently and to solve a problem.
Hmm.
And that can happen to any of us. If we're actually paying attention, we start seeing places where we really can make a difference and address the challenges that are around us.
I appreciated how you help explain why this envisioning skill sometimes erodes over time. You write at one point, the ability to visualize is critically important for imagination. Unfortunately, as we get older, most of us aren't encouraged to practice this skill. Beyond childhood, we stop telling imaginative stories ourselves and focus instead on reading other people's fiction. We stop making artwork and begin looking at other people's creations. I guess one of the reasons this leapt out at me is because my full-time job happens to be teaching music in a college setting, and my wife is a music teacher. And it seems like there are a lot of forces at play in the world which are all about maybe the STEM areas of study,
mm-hmm.
and in particular also you know, business and management and so on, important areas of discipline of study, which can sometimes crowd out the arts. And you are writing here in a way which suggests that that there is a very important place for that kind of study, if for no other reason in just fostering your ability to be creative and imaginative in other arenas in your life.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I was at an art show last night. A friend of mine was displaying some artwork, and I went up to one of the paintings, and it said, you know, artist in the name of the artist. And I thought, isn't that interesting? Does that person define themselves as an artist? Does that mean that I'm not an artist? Right? I'm a musician, artist, writer. Well, I'm a writer. You know why I'm a writer? Because I write. You know, you're an artist if you actually pick up a paintbrush or, you know, some clay. You're a musician if I could, you know, bang some pots together and start making music. I mean, I don't know if you agree with me, but I feel as though by labeling people in this way, it means that the other people label themselves as not that, right? I'm not an artist. I'm not a musician. I'm not a writer. But, of course, we all have these skills. And I really am a huge believer that these are things we should be baking into our lives in all different ways. Yes, I might not be painting all the time, but to know that that's something I could do, you know, I could pick up a paintbrush and express myself that way. Why not?
Absolutely. And, of course, it's only when you're given those opportunities and the invitation and the encouragement to do so that you might even discover creative outlets you didn't even know were there. And,
exactly.
And who knows the ways in which they might be applied, particularly when we get good at this thing called reframing, which you talk about a little later in the book. But one of the most important things that one can do in bringing about innovations and successfully bringing them to the world is not being stuck in the same framework of the present.
Yeah, I spend most of my time teaching. This is what I focus on, is how do you reframe problems? how do you look at a problem from very different angles to come up with really different solutions? I'll give you just a really simple example. Let's imagine we were a friend of ours was having a birthday, and we were going to brainstorm about a birthday party. Let's have a birthday party, and let's come up with ideas. If we change one word in that prompt from let's plan a birthday party to let's plan a birthday celebration, we've now opened up the frame of possibilities. The question you ask is the frame into which the answer will fall. So if you don't ask the question properly at the beginning, you're not going to get as rich a set of solutions.
Right.
And so by just thinking about looking at the problem you're trying to solve in really different ways, subtle to very bold new perspectives, you end up coming with really, really different solutions.
One of my favorite moments in the book that speaks to that is where you had a various teams in one of your classes engaging in brainstorming, and one of the teams was supposed to rethink movie theaters, and they came up with all kinds of interesting ideas, including one in which maybe people, while they're watching a movie, would all be on stationary bicycles. I mean, getting their exercise while they watch this this two-hour movie. I mean, what a fabulous idea. But if the framing of the question was such that the task was to take present-day movie theaters and do what they do just a little better or come out ahead of their competitors, that leaves you stuck in the original frame. But when the question is framed in such a way that you can envision an entirely different kind of movie theater.
Right.
I mean, it's just thrilling to think about the possibilities that, in a sense, are out there just waiting to be discovered or thought of.
Right. That was part of an exercise where I have the students unpack all the assumptions about something. So that was part of all the assumptions of a movie theater or the assumptions of a fast food restaurant or the assumptions about airline travel or hotels. You can pick whatever topic you want. You unpack all your assumptions, and then you turn them upside down. So one of the assumptions was, of course, that you're sitting there quietly, and they questioned that and said, gee, what if we ended up, you know, sort of combining a spin class with a movie theater, and you had sort of a spin class where you're watching a movie, and one of their ideas was you pay at the end, right? If you end up, the more exercise you do, the less you pay for the movie. So the idea is that you actually have an incentive, even a financial incentive, to get more exercise.
Well, there's a whole lot more to be discovered in this wonderful book, which takes us all the way through this cycle, including all kinds of important insights on what it means to take this to that that stage then of entrepreneurship and of persisting through barriers to bring an innovative idea to full fruition. The book again is called Insight Out, Get Ideas Out of Your Head and Into the World. It's published by HarperCollins, and the author, Tina Selig. Professor Selig, this was a great pleasure for me to read your book and to speak with you about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am excited to welcome into our studios Chuck Tyler, a former director of Racine's Parks and Recreation and Cultural Services, a well-known civic leader in Racine for many years, who has written a memoir called Youth in the Center of My Heart. He'll be in our studios tomorrow to share his story and to talk about his book. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, now offering the Sports Management Master's Degree Program. Students learn the business skills necessary to succeed in today's competitive sports environment. Flexible degrees for in-demand careers. More at uwp.edu. Support for WGTD's Morning Show also comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host.